Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. The Assisted Reproductive Treatment Amendment Act came into effect in Victoria on the 1st of March this year. Xavier Simons, a research associate at the Institute of Ethics and Society at the University of Notre Dame in Sydney, came along to explain to us what the legislation does and what it means for gamete donors and their offspring. Xavier has written an article on this topic, which is published today in the MJA. That's the 6th of November 2017. You can find it at mja.com.au. Here's Xavier.
So the Assisted Reproductive Treatment Amendment Act, it's 2016, came into effect on the 1st of March this year, but it allows for the respective release of anonymous donor information to donor-conceived children. So, and that's an Australian first. It allows donor children to know the name, date of birth, ethnicity, physical characteristics, genetic conditions, and donor code of their donor parents, even where anonymity had been requested.
The controversial part of this is, of course, that it's releasing information about donors who only really donated, presumably because they thought they would be anonymous forever.
That's right, exactly, yeah. And there's obviously, there's been a backlash in the community about that.
Which donors specifically are affected?
So the donors affected by the legislation are those who donated before 1st of January 1998. So anonymous donation actually ceased after that date, and all children subsequently donor-conceived in Victoria post-1997 are legally entitled to access information about their donor parents.
The legislation also allows the parents of donor kids to access that information, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So if a child, for example, expresses a desire to know more about their donor parents, or if the parents themselves think that would be beneficial to the child, yes, they can apply for that information. It may even happen that the parent's child is now an adult, but parents decide they want to know a bit more. So yes, that's the case as well.
What kind of effects might this have on guys who donated anonymously and are now exposed in a way that they didn't think they'd ever be? What's going to be the effect, do you think, on them?
Sure. I mean, so I think it's not exactly clear. This is very novel legislation, but I mean, one can speculate that, for example, it'll have a significant psychological and social impact on their lives, or at least on the lives of some. So many donors, you've got to remember, have families of their own, and some of them may have chosen not to disclose to their partner or their children that they had donated gametes. So I'm sure there are donors out there who fear that their partners and family members will react negatively. They'll see it as a form of perhaps infidelity or betrayal.
Let's look at the other side of it. What are the effects on the offspring of donors when they don't get to find out who their biological parents are?
Sure, it's a good question, because that's the other side of the ethical dilemma, the other very important aspect to this debate. So, well, you can for example consider the fact that donor children, not all but many, express this idea of sort of experiencing a fractured identity as a result of not knowing their biological parents. And while evidence suggests that donor-conceived children are psychologically healthy and as psychologically healthy as those conceived by natural means, there's nevertheless a sort of even deeper issue that seems to be present of a desire felt by many donor-conceived children to know their biological heritage, a sort of at the level of meaning, if you will, and a sort of more basic level of identity formation than mere psychology, than mere, for example, a sense of sort of depression or clinical depression or something like that as a result of not knowing this information.
Explain to me what genealogical bewilderment is.
Yeah, so I think that's a good way to frame what we're talking about here. So sometimes we talk about the passage of genetic material as if its significance were confined to the role it performs in directing the functions of the human body or something like that, the development of human beings. Okay, so this is sort of a reductive account of genetics, and the alternative is to see genes as having, say, significant psychological and sociological implications for individual human beings and for communities. So I'll give you an example of why this might be true. So what donor children articulate in their personal narratives is a social and an existential view of the passage of genetic material. So it's something far deeper than, say, a purely physiological phenomenon. From this perspective, a part of the child's identity is missing if they don't have access to information about their donor parents. So this is what genealogical bewilderment refers to. It's this idea that that the children in their identity formation are somehow adversely affected or frustrated by the mystery surrounding their biological origins. And it's something that also is discussed in the context of adoption, anonymous adoption, for example. Well,
I mean, this legislation obviously attempts to be a compromise between the rights of anonymous donors and the rights of kids who want to know, or offspring who want to know, who their father is. Do you think it's a good model?
So that's the question, I suppose. Exactly, and then in the end, it's that's the fundamental question in the broader debate. So I think that the issue, or the act, if you will, is trying to address a moral dilemma, right? It's not sort of a legal dispute. It's a moral dilemma, and someone could say, for example, that there is no right answer here. We just need to, we're going to betray the trust of donors, or we're going to adversely affect the identity formation of donor children, or something like that. Well, rather than supposing that we're facing an irresolvable ethical dilemma, I suggest in my article that the ethical seriousness of the impacts on donor children actually outweighs, or gives us a prima facie, like, kind of on the surface ethical justification for the enactment of retrospective legislation. And I say this tentatively because obviously I understand there are a very strong feeling within the community and within groups of anonymous donor individuals who say that wrong. But I think that the initial lack of regulation of donor anonymity has unwittingly allowed for a serious injustice. And that's something we can't ignore, like when we're sort of considering its validity and whether we can, whether the authorities, whether the government can retrospectively invalidate the sorts of contracts that were made between the health system and donors. So, I mean, I acknowledge, as I say, and I admit this in the article, that there's obviously a sort of an issue here. If someone, for example, seems to in their ethical system prioritizes consent over most other considerations or all other ethical considerations, then I think you'd see this differently. But part of the motivation for the Victorian legislation is that the rights of children in this case are of paramount importance. And I don't think that, from my kind of the particular kind of tradition that I work in ethics, I don't think that's an irrelevant consideration, if you will. I'm sympathetic to it.
Yeah. If you were drafting the legislation, what changes would you make to it to make it better?
Well, I think there needs to be very rigorous monitoring and reviewing of the actual implementation of this legislation, because it is a world first in some respects, and that's sort of something we need to be wary of, because it could go horribly wrong. Donor children, for example, could just totally ignore the fact that the government has stipulated that they cannot contact their donor parents if the donor parent had so expressed that they do not wish to be contacted. So, for example, you could have a case where a donor child just turns up at the house of their donor parent. That this has not been... the fact that anonymous donation has occurred has not been told to the family, and then the donor child appears. So obviously that would be a kind of a catastrophic situation for donor parents. But I mean, I think that if there are robust monitoring procedures, if there's appropriate counselling service or services established for donor children, then I think this legislation is potentially a good model for other states. I think VARTA needs to have appropriate guidelines in place to ensure that that any negative experiences of disclosure and donor-child contact are made to the government and integrated into further amendments of the legislation.
You mentioned the other states. Do you think they will follow on quickly, or do you think they'll play a waiting game on this one?
It's a good question. I think there's with some legislation, there's definitely a phenomenon in which a state or a jurisdiction legalises it first, and then obviously sort of it sets a precedent. It provides an impetus for legislative reform in other jurisdictions. This is a peculiar case, I suppose, because it wasn't actually something that was an issue that significant groups in the community were campaigning for, that groups with a particularly influential voice in the media or in politics were campaigning for. It was, from what I understand, an initiative of the health minister and a small number of her colleagues who basically decided that this was a kind of a moral imperative, if you will, for the government to change the law. But I mean, we don't know. Like, it may be the case that a similar minded health minister, a similar minded health department in another state sees that this is a sort of a positive development, that it's been relatively well implemented 5 years down the track, and we may see legislative reform in other jurisdictions. We shouldn't forget, I suppose, the fact as well that donors donated altruistically in many cases, and I think that's something that perhaps, I mean, we don't have the facility for in our legislative structures to address, to deal with in the way we reveal the information of donors. But one could argue that, well, what about these cases where someone literally it was a totally altruistic decision, sort of some idealistic case, and I mean how manipulative it would be to then sort of betray that trust, if you will, and reveal their details. But obviously we can't do that with legislation to discriminate between cases. And the only other issue I'd raise, which makes even myself, I'm sympathetic to the government's decision to change the legislation, but makes even people working in my tradition nervous, and it's that the decision to change the law actually undermines trust in the health system, potentially, among members of the community. That's part of the issue, is that informed consent is predicated on the idea that consent will last, that's enduring, that's something that will be respected, and that's a basic tenet in medical ethics. And I think that's one of the key issues that would need to be addressed better, I think, in future debates, because I don't think it was addressed particularly well when the legislation was being debated in Parliament. It was papered over, I think.
Yeah. Is there provision for donors to appeal or to, on a case-by-case basis, block access?
Exactly. So I think what there is enshrined in the legislation is that donors can set contract preferences if their donor child wishes to make contact with them. So the donor can decide if any contact takes place at all, and if so, by what means. So sort of phone contact, email, in person, under what term, what place, etc. And I think that's a crucial part of this legislation, is that it's not that donor children have unlimited rights to contact and disrupt the lives of their parents, their biological parents. That's not the case. And that's one of the reasons why we shouldn't see this legislation as riding roughshod over the personal lives of donors. The actual information that's released, if you will, doesn't necessarily or will not have an impact on the lives of donors if they don't want it to, in the sense that they will be able to continue living their lives exactly as it was before their information was released, if they do not agree to contact with the donor child, because the donor child can't actually make contact with not only the donor but the donor's family as well, if the donor has said they don't wish that to happen. So I think that's a significant part of this legislation that perhaps makes it a bit more palatable, if you will, for those who are particularly concerned about consent. It's not only Australia, if you will, that's watching this legislation. It's also other countries, the UK, the US, Scandinavian countries, which have different restrictions on anonymous donation, but all of which did actually allow anonymous donation at some point. And so it's an issue of significance to the global bioethics community, I suppose, of interest to those dealing with this issue in other countries.
Thank you very much for your time.
No worries, it's been a pleasure.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.